Good afternoon and welcome to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Paul Flavin for David Martin Davies. When we think about the filibuster, we think about Jimmy Stewart collapsing on the floor of the Senate and Mr. Smith goes to Washington. Or we think about Rand Paul and his drone filibuster of the nominee for CIA chief back in March. Or maybe, since you're from Texas, you think of Senator Wendy Davis's 11-hour filibuster of abortion legislation last month. Well, this romantic notion is oftentimes for the majority in power just a headache. What do you think of the filibuster in our U.S. Senate? Is it vital to the common good, or is it a tyranny of the minority? Give us a call, 614-8980, and we will put you on the air again, 614-8980. Tonight, a bipartisan group of U.S. senators are sitting down with President Obama to try to avoid a rule change, but Harry Reid, as we just heard in the news, has stated he is determined to reform at least the cabinet appointment section, stating that gridlock that we see is anti-democratic. But what if the filibuster actually represents the wishes of most America? This counterintuitive notion was explored by Ben Idelson, editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal. Ben wrote an analysis of the past 20 years of cloture votes and what was published in the journal back in February. Ben, welcome to The Source.
Thanks very much.
So the Brookings Institution pegged the number of cloture votes at 360, which was a historic record since 2007. Your numbers are actually quite a bit lower in your analysis. What accounts for that number?
Yeah, well, it's a counting filibusters, as a number of the political scientists in this area have said, is a tricky enterprise because there is no sort of definition of a filibuster in the Senate rules. In fact, filibusters are just what we call kind of the absence of rules that limit debate. And so often what people do is they count cloture votes. Those are sort of an imperfect proxy for filibusters. And for purposes of the analysis that I was doing, I thought it made sense to limit the data set to cloture votes that received more than 50 yay votes, meaning there was a majority that wanted to end what may well have been a filibuster, but less than 60, meaning they weren't able to do it. So those are good indicators of cases where the majority wanted to get something done, but because they didn't have 60 votes, they couldn't. And that, I think, is in a lot of contexts what we mean by a filibuster and what we're interested in. So that number comes in a little lower than the sheer number of cloture votes.
In 20 years, you had what exactly? What was the number you came up with?
173.
Okay. So quite a bit lower and maybe a little bit more accurate. But I'm interested in you telling us most people do think that the filibuster is an ingrained kind of constitutional right of the Senate. Why do you think people, I mean, this is just speculation on your part, I'm sure, but why do you think people have that impression?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I mean, my understanding of the, you know, original understanding of the Constitution and so forth is there was no such thing. There certainly was no intention that the Senate would operate, you know, as a de facto 60-vote body. I think people, I mean, I'm speaking well outside my kind of expertise here, but my sense is people in this country have an idea of kind of norms of government as inherently constitutional, when a lot of them are just kind of accumulated practice, you know, often that gets going in a kind of path-dependent, sometimes dysfunctional way. But anyway, it's certainly not in the Constitution.
So you looked at the last 20 years. Tell us why you picked that time frame. It was from 91 to 2010, if I remember correctly?
Yeah, that's right. It's just it's kind of a clean block of time when you have, I think, about five Democratic majority Senates and five Republican majority Senates, and it's, you know, the most recent, you know, several years. But maybe it would be helpful if I take a step back and talk about what the point of this analysis was trying to show. Would that make
sure,
sense?
Sure, go for it.
So the idea here is the filibuster debate is usually framed, I think, sort of in the way that you did in the introduction, which is a tension between majority rule on the one hand and minority rights on the other. And I think people have this sense, understandably, that what the filibuster does is say sometimes a majority of the Senate, even though you have, you know, 55, 56 senators, won't be able to do what they want, and people see that as undemocratic. And then on the other hand, you have the defenders of the filibuster who say, well, you know, this isn't actually a simple democracy we have. It's a republic, and we want protections for the minority, and we don't want narrow majorities kind of getting to do whatever they want. And the point of this analysis was to say there's a larger sense in which that debate may be kind of misconceived, because Senate seats aren't apportioned by population in the first place. So just to kind of put some scale on it, I think Wyoming has about 500,000 people, and Texas, I think, has about 25 or 26 million people. So, you know, 50 times more people in Texas, but both states just get two senators. And the consequence of that dynamic is you can rack up a majority of the Senate with senators who collectively represent a minority of the country. And the point of the analysis was to see how often that happens and if, as a result, the filibuster sometimes operates as a device for blocking majorities of the Senate who don't represent a majority of the country.
And how
by
many...
the time you get to... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, how often did you find it happened?
So over this 20-year period, it's about 1 in 3 have this kind of special character that I'm talking about, which I think is a significant number given the kind of general way the debate's been framed. But it's actually much higher than that in certain sessions of Congress. So depending on who's in the majority in particular, there are some sessions of Congress where filibusters are routinely this kind of device for enforcing the will of the majority of Americans who are represented by a minority of the Senate.
And, yeah, I mean, 33% of the time you're saying the senators that represent the minority actually represent the majority of Americans in terms of their representation. Is that accurate?
That's exactly right, yeah.
So you dispel a couple of the myths associated with filibusters, and I'm thinking about kind of a band of low population states banding together and really, really skewing what we think about when we think about representation. Can you talk about how you did that or talk about what you found?
Yeah, well, I think in the public debate about the filibuster, people sometimes say things, you know, in op-eds I've seen, you know, figures that 11% of the country, you know, if you took the senators representing the smallest states and you put them together, you could get to a filibustering minority, meaning, you know, 41 senators who represent only about 11 or 12% of the country. So one interesting question is whether that, you know, has happened in recent history, and the evidence is that it hasn't.
Yeah, talk about your top 10.
Yeah, well, so it's not if you add up the populations represented by these two coalitions in each of these kind of confrontations, you can find out what are kind of the most counter-majoritarian filibusters that have happened. And they're an interesting mix. I mean, there was a vote in 1991 about access to abortion services for military personnel overseas, where there were, I think, 58 Democrats voting in favor of liberalizing those rules, and they represented actually 68% of the country, but they couldn't do it because they only had 58 and not 60 votes. So there clearly are a lot of cases that kind of fit that conventional paradigm, but there aren't any as extreme as I think people sometimes suggest.
Well, Ben Idelson, editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal, thanks so much for joining us on The Source.
Thanks very much for having me.
We're going to take a quick break here on The Source, but when we come back, we'll be with David Bowes, he's executive vice president of the Cato Institute, talking about filibusters. 614-8980 is the number to call.
Arise today to begin to filibuster John Brennan's nomination for the CIA. I will speak until I can no longer speak. I will speak as long as it takes, until the alarm is sounded from coast to coast that our Constitution is important, that your rights to trial by jury are precious, that no American should be killed by a drone on American soil without first being charged with a crime, without first being found to be guilty by a court, that Americans could be killed in a cafe in San Francisco, or in a restaurant in Houston, or at their home in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Is it abomination?
And of course, that was the filibuster given by Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky regarding drones and the John Brennan nomination to head the CIA. Welcome back to The Source. I'm Paul Flav. We're talking about the U.S. Senate's filibuster rules. The Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has said he is ready to change things up to limit filibusters or to lessen the number of votes majority needs from 60 to stop debate. Obviously, we welcome your calls. 614-8980 is the number. 614-8980. Do you think that the filibuster has run its course, or is this a vital thing for the Senate to have in it? Joining me now is David Bowes, Executive Vice President of the Cato Institute. Mr. Bowes recently answered the question, is the filibuster good or bad for America? David Bowes, welcome to The Source.
Welcome. Thank you.
Well, tell us, is the filibuster good or bad for America?
I think in general it's a good thing. I think it is part of our general constitutional structure. It's not in the Constitution, but it's similar to our constitutional structure, which is very much about slowing down majoritarianism and resisting, restraining majorities. In this particular case, this is a way of requiring more deliberation in the Senate, sometimes even requiring more than a simple majority, which I think in the long run is a good thing, and people in both parties should understand that.
Now, I want to remind people that the Cato Institute is a libertarian think tank. Some people might have an assumption, and that means that they side with the right on this all the time. But back in 2005, you wrote another commentary, Collateral Damage from the Nuclear Option. That was when Republicans were thinking about changing the filibuster rules. So this is something you've thought about for a while now.
Well, that's right, and I am amused and somewhat appalled at how much both sides switch sides on this depending on who's in charge of the Senate. Long time ago, when it looked like Democrats always ran the Senate, it was liberals and Democrats pushing and pushing to narrow the filibuster. They knocked it from 67 to 60, things like that. When Republicans took the Senate, and particularly during the Clinton years, then it was Republicans who started threatening that sort of thing. Well, then in the Bush years, when Bush was nominating judges, Republicans started saying, Democrats are resisting a vote, let's go ahead and do this nuclear option and eliminate filibusters for judicial nominees. The New York Times has switched at least twice now. Editorially, they were in favor of filibuster reform, by which they mean getting rid of it. When Republicans were using the filibuster, they were in favor of it. When Democrats used the filibuster against Bush, they were against filibuster reform, and now they're in favor of it again because it is Republicans using the filibuster. I do think that I at least have the virtue of having been consistent.
I want to read a couple quotes to you that go along with what you were saying. What the American people don't expect is for one party, be it Republican or Democrat, to change the rules in the middle of the game so that they can make all the decisions while the other party is told to sit down and keep quiet. Everyone in this chamber knows that if the majority chooses to end the filibuster, if they choose to change the rules and put an end to Democratic debate, then the fighting and the bitterness and the gridlock will only get worse. That was Harry Reid 5 or 6 years ago. And then another one. Sorry, say it again.
Are you sure that wasn't Barack Obama?
Well, that's what it said in the website that I got this from. So then we have another one. We are locked in a rolling filibuster on every issue, which is totally gridlocking the U.S. Senate. That is wrong. It is wrong for America. And that was Trent Locke back in the late 90s. So this is something that, like you said, where you stand is depends on where you sit.
Well, that's right. And so I think I think it's important to think about this in more than a narrow tactical way. Right now, you have a Democratic president, you have a Democratic majority in the Senate, but not a large majority, and therefore they would like to speed things up in the Senate. But the time will come, possibly only 2 years from now, when there will be a Republican Senate again. And at that point, Democrats should be thinking now, will I be happy 2 years from now when Republicans can pass everything they want with 51 votes? And will I be happy if the day comes that there's another Republican president and his nominees can be passed through on 51 votes? You may remember the name Miguel Estrada. He was one of the star Republican judicial appointees under President Bush. And he never got a vote for his nomination to the appeals court. Not because he didn't have a majority of the Senate, he did, but he didn't have a 60-vote majority, and the Democrats refused to let the Senate work its will, and so eventually he withdrew his nomination. That was regarded as a big Democratic triumph because he was a young guy, a Hispanic, a star, very smart guy. They didn't want him on a federal appeals court, and they were able to block him. And I would just ask Democrats, would they really want to give up the option to do that the next time there's a Republican making judicial appointments?
Now, Tony is on the line. He has a question for us here. Tony, welcome to The Source.
Oh, thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to learn from someone who has more expertise than I regarding the corrosive effect that the filibuster has had on the democratic process. I was reading a very good New Yorker piece a while back describing how no president in American history has seen his initiatives filibustered with anything even approaching the frequency of the tactic with which the tactic has been used against Obama.
Okay, Tony, that's a great question. David Bowes, I think that there are a lot of people that would argue that this is different. They've had so many filibusters. It's skyrocketed in the last 5 years, but maybe you have a different view. What's your take on that opinion?
Well, I think President Obama's gotten quite a bit of his agenda through Congress. I mean, he did get the health care bill. He got the stimulus bill. He got Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed. He got immigration reform through the Senate. It hasn't gone through the House, but that's because Republicans actually have a majority there. So it doesn't look to me like Obama's agenda has been significantly impeded. Now, his nominees right now, a lot of his nominees are being held up through filibusters or the threat of filibusters, and I am sure President Bush is sitting down there a few miles from you thinking, yes, that sounds familiar. I remember my judicial nomination. So I don't know how much difference there is. There's no question we're having an increasingly partisan Washington, D.C. On the other hand, both parties have been responsible for a lot of that, and in the long run, I don't think we want to create a pure majoritarian system. Plus, one thing I would point out about Obama's agenda, some of the Democrats wanted in 2010 to impose filibuster reform so they could get Obamacare through a Senate that was being resistant and using the 60-vote rule. But the fact is that at the time they were complaining about the democratic process, Obamacare was unpopular with the public. So which is more democratic, to do what a majority of the public wants or to do what a majority of the Senate wants?
And that is an interesting question potentially for another day. But I do want to pick up on your line about the American Affordable Health Care Act, because there was a study put out in earlier in March of this year by Dr. Hung Park and Stephen Smith for the American Politics Research, and they released a study of the American perceptions and opinions on the filibusters surrounding the debates around the ACA, and they found that what people were interested in, what people thought, really was based solely on what party they belonged to. So if they were Democrats, they really didn't like the filibuster, and if they weren't, they really liked it. Does that surprise you at all?
No, I've seen a lot of those. In fact, I was just looking at polls on questions like, do you think the government is a threat to your rights and liberties? Well, that number's been going up in general. But right now, of course, Republicans think the federal government is a huge threat to your rights and liberties, Democrats not so much. But 5-8 years ago, it was Democrats who thought the federal government was a huge threat to their rights and liberties, and Republicans who were much less likely to. I would hope we could abstract from any individual president and say, look, we have a $4 trillion federal government. It asserts a whole lot of powers, from the IRS to the NSA to the TSA, and it isn't just a single president. So that government, do you trust it? Do you trust it with more of your freedoms? But yes, there are very partisan divides and partisan switches in many polls like that.
So Sarah Binder at Brookings wrote three things she thought she would like to see reformed to lessen the gridlock. And I'm going to read them off, and I want to see if there's anything on this list that you could be swayed to buy into, or if this is just an up or down situation. So the number one, limit the number of motions subject to a filibuster. Two, ratchet down the number of votes required to invoke cloture based on a successive number of votes, so it would go from 60 to 57 to 54. Finally, Senate should experiment with new modes of advise and consent for nominations. Any of those things resonating with you?
Well, the first one is just effectively to remove the filibuster. If you have to take three votes and at that point you get pure majority, well, then that's not much of a filibuster. So, no, I'm not in favor of that. Revise the mode of advise and consent. Well, I don't know what that means. The Senate is required to approve presidential appointments. You could have more consultation. If you had more consultation in advance, presumably Republicans would have suggested to the president that he not nominate certain of his current appointees. If he didn't take that advice, the advice of the Senate, then I guess they still would have wanted to filibuster. You know, I do think judges get lifetime appointments, and the idea that you should do that on a 51-vote majority, I don't really see why. Why not? I don't see that there would be anything wrong with saying judges require a two-thirds appointment for a lifetime.
What do you think about cabinet members, though? I mean, shouldn't the CEO be able to pick his team?
That's right. Cabinet members, I think, are somewhat different. Those are the president's administration. You vote for the president. He gets to have his administration. And that's generally been the policy. What's happening right now is you do have a sort of crash of several nominations that are particularly controversial. The nomination of Richard Cordray to head the Consumer Financial Protection Board is controversial, not so much because of him, but because of the argument that the board itself is unconstitutional. A federal judge has ruled that that is indeed unconstitutional, and that's working its way through the courts. And Republicans are saying we're not going to approve a director of an agency that is unconstitutionally constituted. In the EPA, you have the particular problem of these secret emails and lack of transparency. And the deputy director is being promoted. It's understandable people are resisting that.
David Bowes, Executive Vice President of the Cato Institute, thanks so much for joining us here on The Source.
Thank you.
This is The Source. We'll be back in just a few minutes. We're going to be talking about education reform here in Texas.